This episode contains strong language which may be offensive to some listeners. Listener's discretion is advised. You're listening to Words and Music, an audio series exploring the life and work of Indiana writers. The nonprofit arts and humanities organization Big Car Collaborative produces this show, and it airs first on 99.1 WQRT LP. Indianapolis. Words and Music is made possible by Indiana Humanities. I'm Oreo Jones, and I will be your host for this episode. I'm an artist musician born and raised in the Hoosier State who migrated from a small town of Warsaw, Indiana, population like 13,000 or something, to Indianapolis, Indiana in the early 2000s. Upon moving to Marion County, I discovered my family and a side of my soul I never knew existed. On this episode, we explore the life and voice of the poet an Indianapolis icon, Etheridge Knight. Born in Corinth, Mississippi, Etheridge Knight would grow to become one of the most prolific voices in the late Black arts movement in the 60s and 70s. We're going to back it up a little bit around the time of the Korean War. Knight served as an Army-trained medical technician during his tour and was severely wounded. After his medical leave, he would find his one of many homes in none other than Indianapolis, Indiana. Unfortunately, due to his injuries, he developed a habit and was later convicted of armed robbery, where he would spend 6 years at the Indiana State Penitentiary.
I died, Korea, from a shrapnel wound, and narcotics resurrected me. I died in 1960 from a prison sentence, and poetry brought me back to life.
That's my pops you just heard. He's going to be acting as the voice of Etheridge throughout this episode. In a dark and dreary jail cell in Michigan City, Knight would begin to find his true voice and calling as a pivotal writer-poet of the 20th century. A couple years into his sentence, Etheridge would correspond with an American poet, author, teacher, and Pulitzer Prize winner Gwendolyn Brooks and Detroit's Dudley Randall from Broadside Press. It was his first published poetry book, Poems from Prison, that would make a splash in the literary world of poetry.
He sees through stone. He sees through stone. He has the secret eyes, this old black one, who under prison skies sits pressed by the sun against the western wall, his pipe between purple gums. The years fall, his, like overripe plums, bursting red flesh on the dark earth. His time is not my time, but I have known him in a time gone. He led me trembling cold into the dark forest, taught me the secret rites, to make it with a woman, to be true to my brothers, to make my spear drink the blood of my enemies. Now black cats circle him, flash white teeth, snarl at the air, mashing green grass beneath shining muscles. Ears peeling his words, he smiles, he knows the hunt, the enemy. He had the secret eyes, he sees through stone.
I caught up with former poet laureate of Indiana, award-winning writer and professor Adrian Matika. We rapped about the legacy of Etheridge, looking at the Midwestern Black experience through the gaze of an icon and the art of meddling.
You know, it's wild to me, man, because Etheridge Knight is one of those people, one of those poets who I feel like has been with me my whole life. But I didn't discover him until I was in college. I had a professor who gave me a copy of his Etheridge Knight's poem, Feeling Fucked Up, and it just changed my whole idea of what a poem could be. I mean, I didn't think you were allowed to do that in a poem. I didn't know you were allowed to curse. I didn't know you were allowed to invoke John Coltrane and Jesus and Mao all in the same poem. Like, it just, my idea of what poetry was at that time was limited to one movement, you know, one argument, one protest. And here comes Etheridge Knight with layers and layers of protest and layers of ideas and emotions. And, you know, once you see that and once you know that's out in the world, it's really hard to go back to Robert Frost. So Yusuf Komunyakaa, who also lived here in Indiana for a while and was friends with Etheridge Knight, wrote this poem called Blue Light Lounge Sutra. And it's about the need to write poems and the need to write, to create art. And he says the need got to be so deep, like over and over again, the need got to be so deep. And when I think about Etheridge Knight's poems, I think about how deep the need is in them, how deep the need to write, to catalog, to say the unsayable truths around his experience as an addict, as in prison, as a veteran, as a Black man, all of those multivalenced kinds of lives that he lived come through in the poetry. I mean, I think, you know, we meddle with language, we meddle with ideas and imagery and emotion, for sure. And I think with Etheridge Knight, one of the things that he was masterful at was troubling the idea of Blackness, troubling the idea of family, and how we are bequeathed these things. And, you know, maybe part of it is his own genealogy, you know, being part of like sort of the, you know, not exactly the great migration to Detroit, but coming from the South up here is a whole other experience, and how there is, there's a version of ourselves that, and it changes wherever we are. So the version of ourselves in, you know, Mississippi is going to naturally be different when you come to Indianapolis. And so trying to change and trying to trouble that experience is central to me when I'm reading those poems. So yeah, meddling. I think so. I think we meddle, but it's more with other people and our, it's like other people's ideas of the world, as much as it is meddling with our own experience and our own emotions. One of the things that always struck me was that his poems are very, immediate in their geography. Like, you know where you are. You know what's happening when you read these poems. There are poets who, you know, their poems always take place in their heads, you know, and that's fine. Like, I like those poets too, but Etheridge Knight's poems always seem to me to be three-dimensional. You know, they seem to me to be a kind of action that I can take part in the real world. And so when I read them, I'm always thinking about Indianapolis only because I know he was writing them in Indianapolis. I don't think he even really talks about the city that much specifically. I think maybe more than his poems, the way that he rendered himself as a citizen of this community was by the Free People's workshops he was running. You know, that's the thing. I mean, his poems impacted everybody who read them. And at the same time, he had a whole other part of his life that was dedicated to supporting and reifying art in Indianapolis, you know, making a space for people to write poems that, where they didn't have to pay, you know, they didn't have to be in a class, they didn't have to have a degree. You just come and write. Come and say, you know, say your truth in this space with people who are willing to listen. And that is an unbelievable gift, as all artists know, right? Every one of us wants a space. And so part of his project in life was creating this space for other writers here in Indianapolis. It's wild because, I mean, he died right around the time I learned about him. And so he's buried in Crown Hill Cemetery. And I used to go back and play ball all the time at the old Bertha Ross Park, which, you know, right across the street. I guess it's on Michigan and, or maybe it's when it becomes MLK, but yeah, right below 38th Street. There it is, Crown Hill, going for miles. And I'm over there playing ball right across from where this guy is buried, and had no idea, you know, no idea that this was going on in our city. In fact, I mentioned the teacher who introduced me to Etheridge Knight's work to begin with, and she didn't tell me he was from Indianapolis. She just gave me one of his poems and said, this seems more, I mean, she didn't say it directly like this, but basically she just said, this seems more like what you're interested in than the stuff we're looking at, you know, as a part of a longer conversation when she said to me that she didn't think she could really help me, but Yusuf Komunyakaa could. And so at the time that was great advice, but now I look back and I wonder if she wasn't just offloading this work. You know, we got this little Black poet here and I really don't know how to deal with Black poetry. So I'm going to give you this and I'm going to send you on your way. I mean, whatever it meant, it's how I found this icon, you know, this icon of not just Indianapolis poetry, but of the Black arts movement. You know, I mean, he was at the center of it. And, you know, it's just like in my mind, I mean, I'm here for Mary Baraka and Sonia Sanchez and all these other really beautiful writers. But in like the branch of the family tree for me, it's Etheridge Knight and Gwendolyn Brooks and also Eugene B. Redmond, who was one of my mentors. And so there's, you know, there's a space that's a Midwestern Black arts. You know, not the one that's situated in New York or on the East Coast, but the one that's here and extends up to Detroit with Melba Joyce Boyd and, you know, Dudley Randall, who published Etheridge Knight. So there's this, you know, this great Midwestern branch to the Black Arts movement, and Etheridge Knight is in the middle of it. Mari Evans is in the middle of it. You know, so we're really, really very fortunate to be their kids. So we have this movement that is, you know, in the way that Gwendolyn Brooks told it, that she's trying to find a way to get the language that she's writing, the poetry she's writing, to the people who it's for, you know, and it's for everyone because poetry is for everyone. But specifically, these poems are written for people on the South Side of Chicago and Black people on the South Side of Chicago. And they need to be able to see themselves in poetry. And so I think the underserved, the part of the conversation that doesn't happen as much as it should, is that this is, you know, the Black Arts Movement is a beautiful example, like, you know, in a different way, the Harlem Renaissance was, of Black people creating an art that's specifically for Black audiences, rendering the Black experience, right? And other people can read, other people can listen, they can join in into the conversation, but it's not necessarily for them. That sounds exclusionary when I put it that way, but it's not. It's radical, because we are still dealing with, we will continue to deal with, you know, art as a space that begins in whiteness. And so if it's beginning with the supposition that somebody white is reading it or somebody white is creating it, then we have to trouble that. And the Black Arts Movement was doing that in significant and beautiful ways. And so, you know, there are different versions of it for the different communities, right? So Sonia Sanchez was writing to a different geography than Gwendolyn Brooks was. Mari Evans is writing to a different geography than Amiri Baraka was. But in the end, the idea of writing toward an audience that needs to see themselves and needs to be empowered is beyond geography. It's beyond nation. There's a great deal of consideration in his work of masculinity, right? Like there's masculinity is at the center, whether he wants it to be or not, from the subjects and the things that you're talking about. But at the same time, even in a, you know, a poem that's intense, like Feeling Fucked Up, the whole thing is about vulnerability, right? And copping to the mistakes that the speaker's made and all of that. And so there is a movement toward, and I think Idea of Ancestry does this too, like there's a movement toward tenderness, there's a movement toward vulnerability that is incredibly difficult for writers to do. You know, one of the things that has always frustrated me as a writer is the need to want to be the hero in the work I do. Like, you know, imagining that this is your mythology that you're creating doesn't leave a lot of room to make mistakes, right? Yeah. You know, so I'm sitting out here writing and I'm like, I've got to be like Odysseus or somebody out here, you know, would be John Henry in my poem. And like trying to do that, you know, naturally resists vulnerability, because if you admit that you made a mistake, then how can you be the king in the myth, you know? And so the fact that he's writing in these spaces that are dangerous and violent and complicated in all these different ways, plus just, you know, the societal push to keep it together, even as everything's falling apart, you know, especially back then, this isn't going to leave you a lot of room. And the fact that he was able to create room to fail and to lose and to be hurt, even as he's talking about Hard Rock Goes to Prison or something, you know, even as he's talking about these things that don't seem like they would involve any kind of generosity or tenderness at all. It's a testament to his gift as a writer and also his perspective as a human being.
Hard Rock returns to prison from the hospital for the criminally insane. Hard Rock was known not to take no shit from nobody, and he had the scars to prove it. Split purple lips, lumbered ears, welts above his yellow eyes, and one long scar that cut across his temple and plowed through a thick canopy of kinky hair. The word was that Hard Rock wasn't mean nigga anymore, that the doctors had bored a hole in his head, cut out part of his brain, and shot electricity through the rest. When they brought Hard Rock back handcuffed and chained, he was turned loose like a freshly jailed stallion to try his new status. And we all waited and watched like a herd of sheep to see if the word was true. As we waited, we wrapped ourselves in the cloak of his exploits. Man, the last time it took 8 screws to put him in the hole. Yeah, remember he smacked the captain with his dinner tray? He set the record for the time in the hole, 67 straight days. Oh, Hard Rock. Man, that's one crazy nigga. And then the jewel of the myth that Hard Rock had once bit a screw on the thumb and poisoned him with syphilitic spit. The testing came to see if Hard Rock was really tame. A hillbilly called him a black son of a bitch and didn't lose his teeth. A screw we knew had had Hard Rock from before shook him down and barked in his face. And Hard Rock did nothing, just grinned and looked silly. His eyes empty like a knot hole in a fence.
And I have this vision of my biological father and my uncles. And, you know, they were on Soul Train right back in the 70s. And so, you know, we lived in LA back then. It was before we came to Indiana. And, you know, I've got these visions of them with these, like, you know, stacks and the shirts and, you know, and these hats and the whole thing. And when I think about the utter coolness of their outfits and the way that they carried themselves in the world, it strikes me as a particular kind of male posture, black male posture in the 70s. And here Etheridge Knight's writing into that, you know, I mean, he's a little before, but he's writing into that, like at the advent of disco and all of that too. So, you know, it's like, there's a lot of stuff happening in his poems and in the world around the poems. Unfortunately, everything that Etheridge Knight was writing about and writing against is still a problem for black people, and particularly black men, because that was, you know, of course that's what he was working through. But the work he was doing about violence in prison, about art, about loss, about addiction, you know, all of these things are timeless. And I mean that in the most unfortunate way. If anything, I mean, there are significantly more black men and women, you know, brown and black men and women in prison right now than there were back then. I mean, who could have ever known that the Reagan administration and the war on drugs and those kinds of things would have somehow made it even worse for black people? And so, you know, he's writing before all that happened and it was already terrible. So, you know, to imagine that somehow his words are even more prescient now, that the observations he's making about the judicial system having no justice in it whatsoever would still be resonating like 50 years later, not getting better, but in fact getting worse, is kind of terrifying. You know, he's saying it. He's showing anybody who's willing to read, he's telling anybody who's willing to listen that the prison system does not rehabilitate anyone. That what it does is make things even worse and gives them a whole different set of traumas. He's telling them that in 1967, you know, and here we are now with those same things, except for the populations are multiplied. With those same problems, except for instead of it being local or state or even federal governments doing this harm, they've contracted a lot of it out to corporations too. So it's a space where, you know, the judicial system, or however we want to frame this, has very transparently moved from being just a bad idea to a actual component of capitalism, at least in the United States. There are people who are much, much more informed and more articulate about prison reform than I am. So I don't want to pretend. All I'm suggesting is that he was telling us then, and it's just gotten worse. if it's all right, I want to circle back really quick to like expand a little bit about Etheridge Knight and, you know, and his poems being about or of or for Indianapolis. Because one of the things I was thinking about is he's got that this really wonderful poem, a poem for the for Third World Brothers that was in Belly Songs. And one of the things that the poem does, you know, is it's talking about America and about the you know, the things that that America does to other places, right? He's got this kind of this bent that is global and outward looking. And so when we were talking earlier about the kind of his transience, right? Like the way that he goes all over the place, I kept thinking about that there, you know, there was a kind of willfulness to it, even as he was a Rolling Stone. There was a kind of willfulness to that that involved learning more about the world and learning more about African diaspora, Pan-Africanism, like these ideas of, you know, blackness and interconnectivity of blackness, right? And so when it comes to Indiana, I mean, you know, this has always been a very homogenous state, but the city of Indianapolis is not. And it never has been, even though for whatever reason, people seem to forget that it's 30% black here, you know? So Etheridge Knight is stepping into a space that has a significant black history and a significant black community, just waiting for the poems he was writing. Mari Evans talked about that too. She talked about when she first moved to Indianapolis, wanting to write poems for the people who, particularly the women, the black women who maybe felt like they weren't seen, or that people didn't understand what they were going through, and she wanted to write poems for them. In a lot of ways, I think Etheridge Knight was writing poems for the black men, you know, black people in general, but specifically black men who, you know, maybe never thought that they would be part of a poem or never imagined that poetry was for them. And then he comes in here swinging with Feeling Fucked Up, or, you know, the idea of ancestry, and these poems just resonate in ways that, you know, it's hard for me to find language for sometimes.
For Etheridge, prison was a womb for the rebirth experience that occurred via reading and writing. He became aware and more sensitive to himself and his environment. Aside from contributing to this sensitivity, prison also afforded Etheridge more time to read, to learn the craft of writing, and to ply his trade for the good and for the good of his brothers within and outside the prison walls. Prison brought Etheridge in contact with many other souls who contributed to his knowledge of self and the much larger world in which he had not been operating very effectively. In lyrical poems about love and loss, pain and passion, Mr. Knight explores feelings with all the honesty and sweet vulnerability of a true human being. The women in his life were pivotal in his writings. His former wife and poet Sonia Sanchez, Mary McNally, and Charlene Blackburn, and other lovers like Elizabeth McKim. There were also the women of his mind and spirit, poets like Mari Evans, whose book I Am a Black Woman he clutched like a security blanket. At the time Etheridge entered prison, the Black Power movement, as we know it today, was being birthed. Because of his sensitivity, the time he had at his disposal, and his propensity for reading, Etheridge was a prime target for the new philosophy and philosophers who had found their way into inmate number 32650's experience. The inmate who had the most profound effect on Etheridge and his works was actually a former inmate who had turned Muslim. One day he appeared on TV and spoke about black man's plight in America. His name was Malcolm X. Upon his release from prison, Knight would move around the country as a mysterious figure of black American folklore. Known for his authenticity of the black experience and his legendary haikus, it was after the release of Belly Song and other poems, Knight grabbed a nomination for the Pulitzer Prize for Poetry in 1973 and would help establish the Free People's Poetry Workshop.
We free singers be. We free singers be. Sometimes swimming in the music, like porpoises playing in the sea. We free singers be, come alligators at times, but we come eagles circling the sun, hurling stones at hunters, becoming scavengers, cracking eggs in the palm of our hands. Remember, oh, do you remember, the days of the raging fires when I clenched my teeth in my sleep and refused to speak in the daylight hours. We free singers be.
baby talk, walkers, high steppers, hip shakers. We free singers be still waters sometimes too. Remember, oh, do you remember the days when children held our hands and danced around in circles and we laughed at the sun? Remember, oh, do you remember how we slept in the shades of the trees and woke up trembling in the darkness? We free singers be voyagers and sing of cities with straight streets and mountains piercing the moon and rivers that never run dry. Remember, oh, do you remember the snow falling on Broadway and the soldiers marching through the city streets with blood on their coat sleeves? Remember, oh, do you remember how we left the Warren movie house, turned up our collars, and rode the subway home? We free singers be, baby. We free singers be.
Hanuku Gavia is assistant director for the Center of Citizenship and Community at Butler University and also happens to be Etheridge's great niece. We shared a conversation about growing up in a creative family, the importance of authenticity, and the initiatives they are taking at Butler University with the Etheridge Knight Project in order to keep his legacy alive today.
Yeah, so he is my great uncle, so my grandfather's brother. I have early memories of when I was probably like 3 or 4, I want to say. So it was after he passed away, my aunt Dale, so Eunice Bowens, she put on the Etheridge Night Festival. And so every year we would go to that. And I remember one of the first, when I was little, I was before I could write anything, I really knew about words or anything. They had asked a lot of the children and the family members to write poems. So my mom had my sister write a poem, and my sister's a writer, so she loves writing. She loves telling stories and all of that. So she wrote a nice, amazing poem. I was too young to write. And I was like, I can't do poems. I don't know enough words. I can't rhyme things. And my mom was like, well, poems don't have to rhyme. Like, your uncle's poems never rhyme. So I just rambled on to her about a butterfly. And she wrote that down and submitted it. And people complimented me on the poem when I went to the festival. So I met all these people and they're like, oh yeah, you're the one that wrote that poem. It was so great and everything. But I remember the memory of him kind of kept alive because of the festival and like stories. And I've heard about him through, especially my aunts, I've talked about him a lot and his poetry. Like one of the poems in particular, like one of his most famous poems, The Idea of Ancestry, they mention there's like a little girl in that, which is my aunt. Well, my mom's sister, older sister. So they always talked about her. Like they were like, oh, that's Kazi's poem. He wrote a poem for my aunt Kazi. And so they always called it Kazi's poem. And so when I got older and read the poem, I was like, this has nothing to do with her. Like, she's mentioned in the poem. Like, it's not about her. But my mom didn't like that poem because she was like, it's not about me. So she wasn't as interested in it. There's kind of like half my family that was and half my family that wasn't. So like Aunt Dale, of course, she was really into the arts and really encouraging like my sister. My mom, she wanted to be an opera singer and go into music, and one of my uncles as well. So there was always this like kind of musical, like all of my aunts and uncles, like my mom's siblings, they all had to take an instrument and were musically inclined. And my grandfather really wanted them to be well-rounded people. So they were all into the arts. I think also it was kind of combining it with trying to be practical. And so there's like this business side, like my grandfather, even though he let my mom go into music, he kind of wanted her also go and get a teaching degree because it's like, well, you might not become a musician, so you need something to fall back on. Mama, so my great grandma, she would write poetry. My sister, my cousins, and I would do like plays and things all the time. And then I've seen videotapes of my uncle reading his poem. Like, his poems are meant to be read. They're meant to be heard. They're not something for, like, I know some artists, they're more interested in the written word and how it looks on paper and kind of like that feel. His was very much a spoken art. So especially like with Elu, the Talking Drummer, some of his other poems, you can, because I know my family members and I've heard him read it before, I can kind of understand the cadence and everything. And so like, I think sometimes on paper, it doesn't go as well. But like one of my favorite poems are some of his haikus. Like there's one that I think it's like Crown Hill Cemetery, which is, I just think it's a really funny poem.
Crown Hill Cemetery, Indianapolis. A black and white dog sniffs gravestones to gravestones. Pees on who's your poet.
So like some of his poems, because he has several that talk about Indiana, especially that kind of echo what he went through when he was in Indiana and some old places like Riverside and other places that are, and that were pretty predominant, and like being in like Indiana Avenue and its heyday and all of that stuff. So I think some of those resonate really well. He also talks about his experience in like Mississippi a lot, but I think something that kind of epitomizes to me Black culture in Indiana is that sense of community and everyone coming together and how everyone kind of knew everybody. So like one of the things that my students found in the archive is something about like he had gotten hurt or in a car accident or something. I can't remember exactly. And they like his friends had made a flyer about raising money for his surgery and to help him out. And they found that so fascinating. I was just like, that's kind of what you did. Like everyone knew everyone. If somebody got hurt, that's what you would do. So like, even for my grandfather, who wasn't like a well-known artist, he was a business owner. He owned a gas station. Like if there's something wrong, people would come together for him. So I think that was kind of one thing that kind of epitomizes like that Black community, especially in Indianapolis, was that like coming together and how he could bring different people together and like how everyone knew everyone and kind of helping everyone out. I think one reason is because he's able to write about it so well. And convey those emotions and feelings. So it's not just about the words and the knowledge of it, but kind of that feeling, like his poetry is able to convey those feelings that you have. He's kind of a figure too. I think he's a very humanizing figure. Like when you think of famous people, like how we idolize them, like Martin Luther King or some other like historical figures, you idolize them and you kind of put them in a bubble. Like for Etheridge Knight, kind of what makes his poetry and who he is like the good, the bad, and the ugly. So like his drug addiction, his incarceration, his relationships with women, they're all out there for everyone to see. So you can kind of see that human side of him. And so I think it humanizes that like historic figures and him especially, like it shows that human side of the Black arts and that we don't have to always be like the perfect like role model and just be like live a perfect life to be somebody great. Butler has a collection, the Etheridge Knight Special Collection in the Irwin Library. So we've been working with some student researchers to get the word out about Etheridge Knight and kind of use some of those archives and materials from the special collection to bring out into the public. So we've partnered with the Center for Black Literature and Culture to create a physical exhibit and a digital exhibit of some of those works found in the archives, and our three student workers, Nate, Dakota, and Chris, they've kind of found certain themes and kind of to highlight though like what they found in the archives. So there's pieces like letters that he's written or other poems that people have sent him, some of his personal writings. So just different things to kind of let people know more about him as a person and hopefully inspire more people. And then with that, we've also done where we have a social media account at EK Free People's Bee that kind of highlights the project and what we're learning and kind of collaborating with different artists in Indianapolis and to get the word more out about Etheridge Knight and do different activities and different like workshops and also highlight some poets and poetry in the local community.
The Idea of Ancestry is one of the most infamous poems that Etheridge Knight wrote in his jail cell. We can see reflected the idea of love and closeness to family, the desire for freedom, and how we can be free in our minds to remember and appreciate the past.
The Idea of Ancestry. Take to the wall of my cell are 47 pictures. 47 Black faces, my father, my mother, grandmothers, one's dead, grandfathers, both dead, brothers, sisters, uncles, aunts, cousins, first and second nieces and nephews. They stare across the space at my sprawling on my bunk. I know their dark eyes, they know mine, I know their style. They know mine. I am all of them. They are all of me. They are farmers. I am a thief. I am me. They are thee. I have at one time or another been in love with my mother, one grandmother, two sisters, two aunts, One went to the asylum, and five cousins. I am now in love with a 70-year-old niece. She sends me written in large block print, and her picture is the only one that smiles at me. I am the same name as my grandfather. Three cousins, three nephews, and one uncle. The uncle disappeared when he was 15. Just took off and caught a freight, they say. He discussed each year when the family has a reunion. He causes uneasiness in the clan. He is an empty space. My father's mother, who is 93, and who keeps the family Bible with everybody's birth dates and death dates in it, always mentions him. There is no place in the Bible for whereabouts unknown. Each fall, the graves of my grandfathers call me. The brown hills and red gullies of Mississippi send out their electric message, galvanizing my genes. Last year, like a salmon quitting the cold ocean leaping and bucking up the stream, I hitchhiked my way from L.A. with 16 caps in my pocket and a monkey on my back, and I almost kicked it with the kinfolk. I walked barefooted in my grandmother's backyard. I smelled the old land in the woods. I sipped corn whiskey from fruit jars with the men. I flirted with the women. I had a ball till caps ran out and my habit came down. That night I looked at my grandmother and split. My guts were screaming for junk, but I was almost contented. It had almost caught up with me. The next day in Memphis, I cracked a croaker's crib for a fix. This year, there is a gray stone wall dammed my stream. And when the falling leaves stir my jeans, I pace my cell or flop on the bunk and stare at the 47 faces across the space. I am all of them. They are all of me. I am me. They are thee. And I have no children to float in the space between.
Award-winning short story writer, essayist, and former professor known for her work exploring Indiana and the Midwest, Susan Neville joins me to talk about her history and interactions with Etheridge Knight.
I'm trying to think. I really can't remember when I first met him. I feel like I've known him for, you know, knew him forever, but maybe it was when I was in Richmond teaching at IU East, but when I started working at Butler, whenever Etheridge was in town, I would try to scrape together some money for him to give a reading, or I hired him to teach a workshop at Butler. So I was almost always able to get him something because he was kind of a gypsy vagabond at times. And made his living going through town and doing readings and teaching workshops. So I hired him to do that. And one of the things, of course, that I always remember is that the check, we would go down to the business office and cash it right away. And then he'd always need a ride to an uncle's or a cousin's. And can you wait in the car for about an hour? And then I'll come out. Okay. Etheridge was really good at establishing community no matter where he was. So when he, you know, lived in Massachusetts for a while, he lived, I think, in Minneapolis, he would start a Free People's Workshop. And he kind of, his teacher was Gwendolyn Brooks, but he also is really associated with thinking about poetry as community. He would constantly use the phrase, the poem, the poet, and the people, like it didn't exist until it was said and received. And he was really influenced in many ways, I think, by Malcolm X. Wherever he was, he built up this, you know, set of people around him. And when he was in Indianapolis the last 2 years of his life, he was dying of cancer the whole time. His family is here and they still live here. He was probably one of the most alive people I've ever met. And so he got musicians, poets, people from really all walks of life who would meet together and say poems and write poems. And he would lead workshops. He was, you know, a hard workshop teacher, but he was also a very incredibly empathetic one and a great listener. So some of the people who were in his workshop in Indianapolis included the poet Jared Carter, who was a good friend of his, and Francie and Stephen Stoller. Stephen Stoller was an artist is an artist still. He lives on the East Coast. They did some shows together and established a really great friendship. The workshop made its own community, its own poetry community in Indianapolis. And once you met Etheridge, you were kind of his friend for life. If he was coming through town, he would contact you. He would, you know, write you notes. He would hit you up for readings. He just was one of those very open, charismatic people. I really was blown away when I heard him read Elu the Talking Drum. Yusuf Komunyakaa has a poem where he kind of used the same voice for the drum in the poem that Eth always did when he was reading this poem. It was like kadoom, kadoom, doom, kadoom, kadoom, doom, doom. The heart beats. He was just a really, really great performer with wonderful, wonderful poems and so much humility in the poems. He, you know, one of the things he said that, and I remember this, and I can't remember what poem it's in, but he said, I never stopped loving anybody. and you know, he was very loving, kind, open, messed up, funny, empathetic. He was a great man. When he talks about when he first started to write poetry, it was while he was in solitary confinement. I became disoriented, out of touch with myself, and almost out of breath. So I started remembering my grandmother, grade school classmates, guys I'd been in the army with. I was so disoriented, so desperate to regain a sense of myself, of who I was. So I started making up lines and phrases out loud, memorizing them, and I started to breathe again. I feel like, you know, poetry really did save him. And part of what we hear in his poetry is the breath, life. And you can't hear it without feeling that breath. He was pretty great. You know, I loved the slashes too. I mean, the way that he wrote his poems so that they were clearly on the page as musical notation. Like, this is how it's to be read. This is where you put in the little bit of syncopation. Here's the slash. And you could hear it when he read.
When Etheridge Knight walked the earth, he made his way to prison, bars, and public and private education institutions. He took the word with him, and he got people talking about him, about themselves, about change. I want to thank Adrian Matika, Susan Neville, and Hanuku Gavia for their thoughtful insight and contributions to this episode. Also, thank you to my father, Mark Powell, for contributing to the soundtrack you hear throughout the program, as well as lending his voice to the poems you heard. Lastly, we want to thank Indiana Humanities and listeners like you. I am Oreo Jones, and this has been another episode of Words and Music for 99.1 WQRT LP Indianapolis.